Greetings and salutations, everyone. I am AC2GS. My name is Roy. I'm net control operator for this, the Limark Technical Net. Limark Technical Net has been going strong for more than 44 years. Every Sunday night at around 8 o'clock, we sit in front of our radios, all of us, and we learn from each other, we teach each other, and hopefully we entertain each other. And I thank you again for coming back here this Sunday night at 8 p.m. when we try and do this all over again. I will drop for a second and follow with the usual links. If you would like to reach me via email, that would be either for mailbag questions. Those were questions that were very popular once upon a time for people who wouldn't be able to get to the repeater on time. And so they would email the questions, and we would discuss them, and they could either listen remotely by radio, or we have an internet-based audio stream that you could listen to, or if you're just busy this night, you can listen to the archived files available. Or if you have a TechNet puzzle to share with me, we're always looking for a puzzle to stimulate discussion. Or if you have a topic of discussion that's in the news that you have expertise in and would like to share it with the rest of us, you can contact me and tell me that you have a special interest in something that's lit up in the news and you'd like to put in your 2 cents, and we'll help you do that. Or if you want to have me nudge Paul on the shoulder and ask him to take a look at some NASA space-related story and comment. Of course, you can email him directly. His email address is spacenetreport@gmail.com. Mine is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Also, I put together, I cut and paste a bunch of interesting articles and sometimes YouTubes that I see throughout the week, and I put it in a link page. You can get to the link page by typing into your browser roy.ac2gs.com. We have a chat room available. Last week it was relatively busy. Sometimes it's quiet, sometimes it's busy. You can reach it by typing into your browser chat.ac2gs.com, and that'll bring you to the chat room. And as I mentioned earlier, we offer an audio stream on the internet of the Technical Net for those people out of radio distance. And we keep it live the rest of the week, so if you're curious what's going on the Glen Oaks repeater, but you don't have a radio near you, you can just type into your browser technet.ac2gs.com, and that'll bring you the audio stream. And I always like to remind people that MikeKC2NJI has a great archive site. It's called amateurradio.tv. He has archives of the Limark Technical Net that go as far back as September 2006. So avail yourself of the wisdom of the hams that have either moved out of the area or unfortunately become silent keys. So that's my link. So I'll drop for a second and come back and tell you what I got planned. Okay, I have a couple little things to say after this point before we get to the usual questions and topics and comments. We'll ask people to hit that push to talk, give me your first name and your call sign, whether it's an amateur radio-related subject or non. We're open to any scientific discussion or technical discussion. But I would like to give the people with amateur radio questions the opportunity to go first, since this is an amateur radio repeater. That should take us to about 10:15. Paul, WS2N, will then join us for the SpaceNet report, which should take us approximately to 11 p.m., and I will return to put a bow on everything and wish you well for the coming week. So that's the game plan. If my Shack Electronics doesn't screw anything up and the repeater doesn't screw anything up and the laws of physics remain the same. So that's the plan. So as I said before, I would like to make a couple of initial statements before we get to the questions and topics. So I'll drop for a second, and I'll be right back. Okay. Last week we had a very interesting discussion about the temperature humidity index that the weather ladies used to mention it, and then all of a sudden they stopped. And I've got a little bit further research on the subject. Someone brought up the Real Feel, which is an AccuWeather copyrighted proprietary algorithm. What it amounts to, as far as I can figure, is they've gone a little bit deeper, a wee bit esoteric into the whole idea of a temperature humidity index. Nowadays, things like AccuWeather's Real Feel includes not only the temperature and the humidity, but factors in the cloud cover and wind and sun intensity and even the angle of the sun. And you know, there are other things called the heat index calculator. So I think what happened is the simple equation got fractured into a whole bunch of either proprietary or copyrighted algorithms, and that's what we're stuck with. They might align very closely with the THI of yore, but apparently they have put secret sauce into it. So that's what I've gleaned in my research over the last week. I hope people will look further into it, and if they discover new little nuances, feel free to come back here and tell it to the rest of us. Anyway, that was my little 2 cents opener. Now we're open for questions, comments, and topics. Just hit that push to talk, give me your first name, and your call sign.
K2TGW, Les, and I have a question for you. I need help.
Interesting enough to everybody. Science questions, Wesley.
Les and Wes recognized. You rhyme. Anyone else want to put their name on the list? Well, hopefully as time goes on, there'll be more people with more questions. We'll see what happens. I'll open up for questions as the night progresses. Les, what can I do you for?
All right, as a devotee of anything new that I can find to do, I am into the digital D-Star, et cetera. I have a number of hotspots, which I really enjoy sitting on the lounge in a backyard in the shade, a little HD, and literally talking to the world. Now, I have a number of hotspots, some of which seem to be really simple, and some don't seem to. I haven't been able to open up all the benefits of them. I have a couple of TYT. I have one MD390. I also have a UV380. Now, there is a program out there called TY MD380 Tools. That's TOOLZ. There are a number of there are quite a few videos, YouTube videos, that tells you how to implement them. But all the sources they give you to get to that program looks like they haven't been touched or updated since Columbus came over, and you cannot get that program. Another hand that saw me advertise for help on some of the help channels said he would like to have the answer too. And he said, but he thinks there's a number of TYMD380 tools programs. I hate to show my ignorance, but I'm sort of baffled and I cannot find what I want. Of course, once I get it working, I'll look for something else to do, but that's the name of the game. So any help I can get from the general public, or you, Roy, very, very welcome. K2TGW, back to Ned.
Okay, very good, Les. We'll open it up and see if people can help you. You're not really talking about hotspots. What you listed are the handy talkies. This MD380 is a monobander. It's relatively low priced. I have one of them. And they haven't been kind of upgraded for about 4 or 5 years, which is why what you're talking about is a toolbox firmware upgrade that didn't come from the manufacturer. It came from guys out there who love to tinker with handy-talkie firmware, and they were able to add a whole bunch of interesting features to the MD380 model handy-talkie. You're not going to probably get new versions again because the last time I looked was about 2 years ago, and even those files were kind of aging. The idea of boosting the firmware to get you more features kind of came and went. So I'm sure if you do enough Googling or if you do torrent searches, you'll find place repositories where they have the old MD380 toolbox software. How far have you dived down that rabbit hole so far?
Very far. You find locations. Let's see, there were three hands or three groups that have worked on it. One is a gentleman in Texas. KG5RKI, but there's no downloadable 380 tool download. Another one is supposedly is VA3XPR. That doesn't help either. And then the granddaddy of all is MyCor, and he gives you all the instructions how to do it, but not how to get through the program. And all the YouTube videos name any one of the, or two or three of those, but you can't find what you need to use, so that's why I'm looking for help. Back to you, Roy.
Yes, John.
I don't know all the ins and outs of everyone who worked on the MD380 tools, but my buddy Travis in Philadelphia, I think he's one of the original people, if not the first guy to really do that. Anyway, don't remember his call sign because I've never talked to him on the radio, only in person. Anyway, if he has trouble finding it, I'm sure, because I've got an MD380 too, I'm sure in my hoard of digital stuff, I probably have already downloaded and kept that. But I've never loaded it on the radio, actually, surprisingly. Anyway, I might have it if he needs it, if he can't find it, but I bet it's out there. That was such a popular package, I'd be really surprised if we couldn't find a download for it. Anyway, just my 2 cents. KC2SHO, just look me up on QRZ. I can always share those files with you.
Okay, very good, John. Yeah, for less, if you go to GitHub, the gentleman that John was mentioning goes by the name Travis Goodspeed, all one word. And he has a directory on GitHub that's called MD380 Tools, which is loads of files. So they're old files, like we've been talking, but the files seem to be there. So I would suggest that you just look up, you can Google Travis Goodspeed and look to see if there's a GitHub entry in the Google and go to the page because I'm looking at it right now.
Okay, good way to look. Good something to do for tomorrow morning and see if I can find out more information because I now have a trailer of people who want my help if I can find out what it is. I've heard of all these things. Travis Goodspeed somewhere was mentioning something, but all right. I will look it up tomorrow morning and see what I can find. I find it, I'll be happy to report back next week.
Okay, very good. I think you'll find what you're looking for, because like I said, I'm looking at a full page of GitHub. GitHub, thankfully, doesn't, their pages don't go old. The problem with a lot of curious little tricks that people have on the internet is they put them into sites that have somewhat limited life expectancy. So, you know, if some guy was working on it, and these files go back as far as 8 years ago. So if they kind of worked on it 8, 9 years ago and something happened to them and no one's paying the bill on the web hosting and all of a sudden there are all these orphaned links. But GitHub, I believe, is owned by Microsoft. It's not going anyplace. So I wish you good luck, Les, and I do hope you come back next week or sometime in the future. Tell us how it worked and share your experiences with us.
Roy, it'll be my pleasure. Thanks for the help.
You're welcome. My pleasure, too. Well, we have Wes, but Wes tells us that it's not going to be amateur radio-related questions, so just in case someone strolled in late and has an amateur radio question, please hit that push-to-talk. Give me your ID, your call sign, and your first name. Once again, anyone out there with any amateur radio-related questions, comments, or topics, please hit that push to talk and ID yourself. Okay, perhaps later on in the night there'll be more questions. Or maybe I should have taken longer to answer Les's question. We'll see. Wes, I guess you're up now.
Thank you very much, and to Xian. So I have a few topics to discuss. We can make it quick if you want. Not concentrating on certain things more than is required. So I'm going to start with the least popular one, or actually the most criticized one, which I criticize too, but I'm not in here to make an opinion. Okay, so I sent a few days ago, that was August 1st, 6 days ago, I sent 2 hours ago Elon Musk neural link has implanted its second patient with the brain chip. And we know that the first one, only the 15% of the 400 electrodes bearing stress implanted in the brain of Neuralink's first human brain chip patient continued to work properly. At the same time, let me jump. Neuralink received regulatory approval for its second test along with the modified procedure. But the name of the second person shows up only for the moment on the internet link that I had and then asked for email. So I don't have the second name, second patient name. But there are plenty of criticism, including his own daughter, Vivian Wilson. And, I'm not going to repeat the words, very much unpleasant. So, Dr. Roy, please comment on it.
Well, I don't have a great deal to comment on. The underlying technology is not really from them. He basically hired a graduate student working with a renowned neuroscientist and basically copied all of the technology. He experimented on a bunch of animals who all kind of suffered and died. And I don't know if he learned anything from that. Probably not. I don't think it's, I don't think much of his technology at this point. It's too early for human research, and I think he bent a couple of elbows and such to get approval. He seems to get approval where the average schmo would never get approval, and it usually doesn't turn out well. So I wouldn't take much, I wouldn't be that interested in his entire company. I don't think they're going to be able to accomplish any of the things that he claimed, because he's talking about telepathy and all kinds of nonsense that you know, almost everyone, including the guy who he hired to steal the information, basically quit and discussed over the claim. So this is just public relations BS, in my personal opinion. I won't go into details of my general opinion of the gentleman, but I think it's meaningless.
If anybody has any comments, I would appreciate that. Okay, no comments. I'm not sure if a poll is available, because I have goodbye Neil White for Paul to comment. Paul, are you there?
I copy you. How you doing, Wes? WS1.
Thank you very much, Paul. So, NASA only to space telescope dedicated to planetary defense has turned off its transmitter for the last time, ending its 15-year career, detecting near-Earth asteroids and comets. They don't have any...
Got a problem with your signal. You're being blocked.
Hold up. Oh, the
machine. Yeah, I know what he's talking about, there, Roy.
Let's change the subject. Hold on.
Okay, Wes, I know what you're talking about anyway. WS2.
Go ahead, please.
That was a NEOWISE spacecraft that's been up there, what, I don't know, many, many years, I think, 2000 and, what did I read, 9 or something. But anyway, that it used to be the WISE spacecraft. Then they, you know, you used to study the, the universe, you know, looking out. And then as time went on, it did its job. They didn't need it anymore, so they turned it into an asteroid hunter, and that's why they call it near-wise, you know, near-Earth objects, looking for anything out there. But there's nothing to replace it right now. I spoke about this, a few months ago, about some kind of a replacement, they just need the funding. I think it's going to cost $175 million or something, where they could have the spacecraft following Earth all the way, you know, all the way around the sun, so it won't be orbiting Earth. It'll be just looking out. Anyway, Wes, let me see if I have it. That, flies with the Wide Field Infrared Survey Explorer. I just looked it up. 2009. My memory's getting better. I thought it was supposed to get worse when I got older. Anyway. It looked at 300 trillion tons.
Wow.
So it was very successful. But it also looked for black holes. And then, sure enough, like I said, it switched over to NEO-WISE, N-E-O-WISE. So, another one bites the dust, I guess. Back to you, Wes.
Yeah, you did have found 25 new comets and 44,000 objects that were known already in the solar system and outside of it for NASA. And since I have you here, I believe I can have another one.
Somebody of these things.
Actually, it's a joke. It's for entertainment.
A lot of space holes. Different types
so,
are up there. But this one was, we followed, from the day it launched. And I don't know what's going to happen to it now. I guess they'll just deactivate it. Anyway, I'm trying to look for its orbit.
Am I being heard now? Oh.
Yeah, you're being heard.
Okay, so the next one is for entertainment. So the sun along with the entire solar system orbits around the Milky Way galaxy, and it moves in 450,000 miles per hour, which is 828,000 kilometers per hour, and the solar orbit, the center of the Milky Way, is moving at 140 miles per second, and it takes about 230 million years to complete one orbit for our galaxy, our solar system around the Milky Way. And the question of why we are not colliding with other solar bodies or other bodies in space, that we're moving along with the sun in such a speed.
Because most of space is empty. 99.9999% is empty space.
Okay, so we made that quite fast. Yeah, from early age we thought that we understand the planets in our solar system change position when orbiting a central star, the sun. But there are plenty of questions some people may not have the answer for. Okay, the second one for the entertainment is, let me make the power smaller. Okay. The thermosphere here is the layer in the Earth's atmosphere directly above the mesosphere and below the exosphere. Within this layer of the atmosphere, the ultraviolet radiation causes photodisionization of molecules creating ions. The thermosphere thus constitutes the larger part of ionosphere. And the thermospheric temperatures could increase to 2,000 degrees of centigrade, which is 3,630 degrees of Fahrenheit. So the question is, the radio wave could heat, actually, there was the HARP, high frequency active auroral system, but even small power transmitter could heat this layer to quite big temperatures, and that is proven. So the question is, why the spacecraft doesn't melt when it's moving through the thermosphere and to HGN?
Just because it can get to that temperature doesn't mean it is that temperature, and it usually isn't that temperature, and so it doesn't. A possible temperature does not have an effect. It's the actual temperature that would have an effect. I don't know a better way of explaining it.
Well, my understanding is that Big E is about 80 kilometers, which is 50 miles above the sea level. The density of the molecules, air molecules, are not that great to affect the spacecraft moving at a certain speed, even though that it could rise to 3,630 degrees of Fahrenheit. Am I right? And to exceed.
Well, yeah, temperature is average kinetic energy, and the amount of gas molecules up there are not really terribly consequential. So you don't really have that much thermal dissipation required. You need it when you're falling down. The air friction and such heats up the surface of these spaceships a lot. But going up, as far as I understand it, the temperatures are far easier to deal with.
In addition, the radiation causes atmospheric particles in this layer to become electrically charged, enabling radio waves to be refracted and thus be received beyond the horizon in the exosphere, beginning at, I remember, 370, maybe 375 miles above the sea level. The atmosphere turns into the space, although there was called Carmeline, I believe, that was reaching about 100 kilometers, but I'm not sure. Anyhow, these highly attenuated gas I'm reading right now, in this layer can reach even 4,530 Fahrenheit, degrees of Fahrenheit. So despite of the high temperature, an observer or object will experience low temperatures in the thermosphere because the extremely low density of the gas, practically a hard vacuum, is insufficient for molecules to conduct heat. End of quote. Dr. Roy.
Okay, I mean, like I said before, temperature is average kinetic energy of particles. High enough in the atmosphere, the amount of particle density is very low. So the total amount of energy is very low, despite the fact that the rare occasional nitrogen or oxygen atom has a lot of kinetic energy by itself. There's so few that it's not going to really do anything. So you also have to factor in the thermal conductivity, and at low atmosphere pressures, there's very little thermal conductivity.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
I just have a couple of comments. First of all, the NEO-WISE spacecraft that's around 300, a little over 300 miles above the surface of the Earth, so I guess that's going to stay there a while. I didn't hear anything about deorbiting it. It's also in a polar orbit, so it that makes a difference as well. So we don't know what's going to happen with that thing over time. And that was an infrared telescope. So the reason it didn't last forever, and they needed to give it a different name and a different job looking for asteroids, because the gases, eventually evaporated. They have to put helium on board and keeping everything cold. When that all goes away, then the infrared doesn't work anymore. So they're able to use the optics, though, for asteroid hunting. And as far as the thermal effect, with the spacecraft coming through, like you said, it goes up to 3,000 degrees. Let me drop it. Or even more. One that comes back from the moon, it's going 25,000 miles per hour, as opposed to 17,000 miles per hour with a spacecraft in orbit, like Dragon or a Russian Progress vehicle. But you notice they always come down with the blunt end first, heat shield first. And sure, the heat shield is designed to take extreme high temperatures, but the reason they come down with the blunt end first instead of the pointy end first, you don't come, if you came through with a sharp point, facing the other way, the vehicle wouldn't be pushing the air away. The air would be getting hot. And like Roy said before, the temperature touching the skin would get up to, maybe 3,000 or more degrees. That could cause a failure. But coming through blunt end first, you got to remember, it's not only temperature, but it creates eventually pressure. It's pushing the air, the hot air now, away from the vehicle. There's actually maybe an inch or two difference between the actual air and the heat shield itself, because it's compressing anything in front of it. So that air is being compressed, and that helps to keep the temperature, the real temperature, away from the heat shield itself. So that's why they do that. Blunt end first, not the pointy end. Anyway, back to you, Roy.
Okay, very good, Paul. I hope you got your question answered, Wes.
Let's go to the next one. Okay. 2 days ago, I had sent Mr. Roy a video that I was connected with, not because it was something special, but because of representation of the scientists that decided to take a stand here, and it was the day Einstein cracked the biggest problem in physics and know it. Physicists use quantum computers to simulate a holographic wormhole and transport information through it. The baby wormhole created a global system where true quantum computer was not created with gravity, but through quantum entanglement. The linking of two particles such as measuring quantum instantaneously affect each other. So let's say you can imagine that we have a top of the Empire State Building and top of Eiffel's tower in Paris. So scientists say that they do the transportation. every day. It's a teleportation every day. So it's not something weird, they do. And they have it. And they actually explained the process, but I would love if Dr. Roy had a chance to comment on it, Dr. Roy.
Yeah, it's a YouTube. You know, I think it's a kind of example of very clever, very smart theoretical physicists kind of staring a little too long at their belly button and coming up with some interesting theories that I don't know. Let me give you the gist of it. By the way, when they say that the teleportation, again, teleportation is not like Star Trek. It is not taking a glass of water and having it disappear at a certain location, say in Texas, and appear in Brooklyn. Teleportation, the way theoretical physicists discuss in terms of entanglement, is information, that the information available in Texas is transferred to Brooklyn, but not the particles themselves. And of course, there's a little get-out-of-jail-free card that you have to do something using standard physics to sort of trigger that effect, so you can't ultimately get the information instantaneously, but it's limited by some secondary aspect of the experiment. But entanglement has been proven repeatedly in labs. You can do it in a reasonably sized university environment and demonstrate quantum entanglement. So it's not a theory. It's not an idea someone had. It's a real thing. You could do it in a lab. You can demonstrate it. My problem with it, let me drop for a second. I don't want to time out everything. My problem is that they've decided that quantum entanglement is the same thing as two linked together black holes, which haven't been demonstrated, to form something that we now call wormholes, which are completely theoretical. There have been absolutely no demonstrations that wormholes exist anywhere. And there's a lot of problems in that the theoretical constraints of wormholes would require that the tunnel that it travels through would be incredibly small and not large enough to fit anything known in science. There's some talk that negative energy can open up the tunnel, but I'm not quite sure what negative energy is, and I tend to think that sometimes theoretical physicists kind of play around with the term a little bit loose. So their idea is, why don't we say that quantum entangled particles are the same thing as two micro black holes with a wormhole between them? Like, sure, why not? And they then decided that they could use quantum entangled bits from a quantum computer to do a simulation of a wormhole and see if they got anything similar out. And it was very noisy and very, very difficult to discern, but they feel that they've started looking into it, but they haven't proved it. Just because two things act similarly don't make them identically the same. Gravity has an inverse square law, just as are radio waves. But electromagnetism isn't gravity, and gravity isn't electromagnetism. So they're very, very smart guys, much smarter than I, but I think they're going down their own little weird rabbit hole, in my humble opinion.
Yeah, you mentioned the theoretical construct, the wormholes. It is a negative energy that appears in speculative theory of wormholes, where it is needed to keep the wormhole open. Wormhole is directly connected to locations which may be separated, I would say, arbitrarily far apart in both space and time, and in principle allows near instantaneous travel between them. So that's the construct, ladies and gentlemen. So the physicists in that video were trying to say, okay, we have a qubit in Eiffel Tower and we have a qubit in Empire State Building. And immediately we have that wormhole open, and immediately the information, let's say we have a 6 qubits or we have a 9 qubits, we can transfer the qubits to Paris from New York, let's say, or so actually they were trying to explain the structure of this new form of the computer using the qubit. So if Dr. Roy would actually say a few words about it.
Okay. They weren't doing long-distance teleportation. They were doing real short distance. They were doing it in the same chip. They're using a fabricated qubit chip for quantum computers. I think it's capable of 54 qubits. Unfortunately, they found that most of the qubits were not stable enough for the experiment, and so they scaled it down, I believe, to a two seven qubit experiments, where a group of seven qubits would be entangled with the other seven qubits, and they would perform some kind of operation on the qubits and determine the results of the entangled qubits. But they were all in the same chip, as far as I can recall.
Thank you for that. As far as the negative energy, it is practically done. Multiple beams of laser light such that, let's say, destructive quantum interference, you can suppress the vacuum fluctuations. So that squeezed vacuum state involves negative energy, and the repetitive waveform of light leads to alternating regions of positive and negative energy. That is being, I mean, I'm trying to describe the squeezed light. The squeezed light phenomena. Back to you.
I don't think you could apply that to the wormhole. You're messing up your positive energy with your negative energy. It doesn't react well to positive energy. So you would have to have a pure stream of negative energy, and lots of luck doing that.
Okay, so what do you think, where we are now? Where the science is now with that new quantum computer?
Well, I mean, it's not like I get the quantum computers monthly. As far as I'm aware, it continues to be in its very primitive initial form. They're perfecting newer designs. They're building units with larger arrays of qubits. The algorithms have been incredibly simple. I did a short report on quantum computers probably about a year ago, and they discovered that, 7 times 5 is 35, which I probably, you could find some second or third graders who could do that too. So, their results have been incredibly early and dubious. Whether over time this will mature into a sophisticated field in which, as they tried to do in the discussion that they were talking about, model quantum mechanical processes inside of a quantum computer and simulate them to a realistic degree, that'll be interesting. But it's yet to be fundamentally proven. They're all kind of optimistic. As everyone's been optimistic about the string theory, which I was optimistic with once upon a time, but string theory's been going on for about 30 years, and nothing practical has come out of it yet, but they're going to be working on it for at least another 50 years before they look someplace else. I understand, because there's not much to look else. The problem with string theory is that seems to hold promise of understanding the concept of quantum gravity, which unfortunately physics can't really do anything much with. There's a very great difficulty with combining general relativity and quantum mechanics. They seem not to go together. So we either got it slightly wrong or there's a bridge that we have no clue of. So, I mean, that's the aspect of cutting-edge physics these days. There's a lot of people going down a lot of blind tunnels, unfortunately. And you never know when you hit pay dirt until you hit pay dirt.
I'm not sure if you, I don't know if you remember at the beginning of the video they were showing the spin of the particles, left one, right one, and the up-down. And they say that the particle could actually be up and down at the same time. Do you remember that part?
That goes way back to, you know, 1910. That's a superimposition is what that is. That's Schrodinger's cat. You know the old story about Schrodinger's cat, where you put a cat in a box with a poison pill that has a gets triggered by random radioactive decay, and the wave function of whether the cat is alive or dead is that it's simultaneously alive and dead in the box. It is only when you open the box that the probability function decays down to it's either alive or it's dead. So the whole thing about quantum mechanics is that everything can exist as a superposition of multiple states at the same exact time as long as you do not test the state. Once anything or anyone looks at the object or tries to assess it, you collapse the wave function and it is no longer in a superposition.
Are you trying to employ Schrodinger's head? Cat in it?
Yes, Schrodinger's cat is the usual way that most physicists explain superposition to non-physicists. It's to the point where almost everyone knows about Schrodinger's cat. Some people don't understand exactly what the point was, but if you ask the average guy if he's heard of Schrodinger's cat, I would assume that at least 50% would say yeah.
Okay, so half dead, half alive at the same time. I think we beat the subject enough, and we can go to the next one, which would be pressure. That was an interesting one. Okay, so let's say Dr. Roy is mad at me and he's trying to squeeze me. But he then all of a sudden feels that he's a superhero. And he squeezed me very well. And then I start to feel the pressure. So physicists have a pretty good handle of how stuff behaves. But something weird happens when you keep squeezing and squeezing and squeezing and squeezing. And in New York, we have a New York State government sponsor and University of Rochester and United States Department of Energy a facility that exists here since 1970. And it is being called the Lab for Laser Energetic, LELLE. It is a scientific research facility located in Brighton, New York. It's a Brighton 12. Okay. So, it was established as a center for investigation of interaction of intense radiation with matter. And I was talking about the always increasing pressure till I went to the point that when the pressure rises over 100 billions of atmospheres, which is actually much more than if we were in the center of the Earth, it is rather if we were in the center of Jupiter, I assume, in the Sun. Okay. I'm going to give a better analogy. Let's say that we put Manhattan Island and all its weights put at a very, very small sample, the few micrometers big sample, that will create a pressure quite big, like 100 billion atmospheres, maybe not, but close enough. So, scientists decided they're going to use laser beam, and laser beam is a plasma. So, the pressure of that plasma squeezes helium-3 that could be compared to that Manhattan Island falling into the sample. And scientists tripled the power of 192 lasers called Omega to study possibilities. And approximately at that pressure we have a nuclear fusion. And that was my whole communication with Dr. Roy. Dr. Roy, please comment on it.
Yeah, lasers are not plasma. Lasers are photons, high energy photons, coherent photons, but photons. Ions are ionized atoms, where at least one electron has been knocked off its neutral shell, and it now carries a net charge. I think what you're alluding to is one of the methods that they're trying to induce fusion reactions is using high-energy lasers to energize the hydrogen and deuterium and tritium and ionize it and increase the temperature and increase the local pressure in a very small space and provoke a fusion reaction. Pressure is just another form of force. So any kind of force, if you have enough of it, can do interesting things. There is something called electron degeneracy pressure, which is the thing that keeps protons, and electrons, and doesn't allow electrons to just willy-nilly drop into a proton and cause it to become a neutron with a whole bunch of other stuff. That's electron degeneracy pressure. If you have enough gravitational force in something like a pre-neutron star to get past the electron degeneracy pressure, you will get the electron capture. You'll get a big explosion. That's what gives us those lovely little, massive exploding stars. And if the mass is left, there's enough mass left, you get neutron stars as a result. But neutron stars require a lot of gravitational force. If you actually took a little teaspoon of a neutron star and separated it from the neutron star and removed the all that gravitational force, the little bit of a neutron star, rather than just staying in your teaspoon, is going to explode back into regular matter. As neutrons decay into protons and electrons and such. So, I don't know. That's my two cents.
Maybe I didn't formulate properly what I wanted to say, but laser ionization plasma is formed when the laser beam rapidly hits and ionizes surrounding gases to form plasma. And there are a few methods for it. One is the interference pattern of two laser shapes, an neutral gas with regions of high laser intensity ionizing into a plasma of regions of laser intensity. Whatever. That's what I was trying to say, so excuse my English, not good in it. But the laser overlap of laser energetic is quite potent or quite strong, I would say. And there are two methods. One is collider, and the other one is laser to be used. So they're trying to use laser, actually, to get the pressure and see what happened if they would be able to get into the pressure that would allow them to have a nuclear fusion bacteria.
Yeah, that was what the experiment. But unfortunately, they didn't. They when they said that their latest experiment.